While most of us would rather forget the long lockdown days of the COVID-19 pandemic, health officials continue to scrutinise the global response to it in a bid to learn lessons for next time. And with winter on its way and Mpox and the Marburg virus hitting the headlines, it seems only prudent to ask how prepared we are for the next global pandemic. You're listening to the latest podcast from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, or SWP for short, here in Berlin. This is where we discuss what's on the minds of policymakers, or at the very least, what should be on their minds. In today's episode, we'll explore how the global health community can become more resilient to public health threats, especially in a world increasingly complicated by conflict, political turmoil, and government budget cuts. I'm your host, Esme Nicholson, and to address these issues, I'm joined today by two of SWP's experts for whom COVID is still very much a part of their everyday lives, at least on paper, as they near the end of a two-year research project examining how to make the global response to the next pandemic more robust in more uncertain times. Our first guest is Pedro Villarreal, whose research focuses on global health law and the role of the World Health Organization in pandemic preparedness. Pedro, it's great to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Esme. Great to be here.
And our second guest is Michael Beierlein, whose research examines global health policy within the political system of the European Union. Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
The COVID-19 pandemic exposed the shortcomings of health systems across the world and weak spots in global and European health governance. I'd like to explore what, in the course of your research project, you've learned about how to ensure a more robust response when it comes to fighting the spread of diseases. Let's perhaps start here in Europe and in Germany. How can the EU work together to strengthen global resilience to such health challenges? Pedro, perhaps you could start.
Yes, very gladly. I think the European Union could step in and show some leadership at the global level, particularly when other partners show themselves to be not so reliable on the long term and at least not so stable in terms of their commitment to global health. The European Union can show this side of stability and continue to invest in the field. They have done so recently by creating partnerships with the African Union and also with the Pan American Health Organization. So I think they're already putting in place a global health strategy, which takes into consideration this global dimension and takes it seriously. And I think the EU would do well not to forget what it is that brought us to the COVID-19 debacle, so the lack of multilateral cooperation and proper multilateral cooperation during a pandemic.
And to what extent do economic disparities within the EU play a part in how vulnerable public health systems are, and what can be done to tackle this, Michael?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So during the pandemic, economically deprived regions were hit particularly hard, especially in the second year of the pandemic. In these regions, the excess mortality rate, which is the percentage deviation from the number of deaths that we would have expected in these regions, was with about like 20%, twice as large as in the regions that were classified as more developed or economically stronger. And these less developed regions, that they are mostly found in Eastern Europe, but also in other parts of the EU and other member states, like Italy, for example, where the region of Apulia in the south had an excess mortality of 18%, which was twice as large as the rest of the country. And in order to be better prepared for the next pandemic, the EU has to overcome these scathing inequalities and address the economic determinants of health. And the EU already has tools at its disposal to do so, which are the structural and investment funds that are specifically designed to overcome these regional inequalities. And the EU is not yet using these funds to their fullest potential, especially in the context of strengthening public health resilience. And our evidence already shows that regions successfully funded by these funds had a much better performance during the pandemic when compared to regions that were not successfully funded yet, which also had a much larger or higher excess mortality rate.
And what about the EU's reliance on importing medical goods? How much of a risk is it, and how can it be mitigated? Pedro?
Yes, if I may, in my view, it's a risk to the extent that the European Union currently, when it comes to pharmaceutical production in particular, well, the production of all medical goods, not just pharmaceutical products, is quite dependent on other countries outside of the European Union to contribute with, be it raw materials and active substances that are necessary to produce those goods, including China, including India, and other countries around the world. And this, to me, is the natural outcome of a need to drive costs down, right, so that as many medicines as possible are affordable for the healthcare system. So I think it's a dilemma insofar as the market itself has ensured that the best way so far, at least the best way that the companies have found to cut costs, is to drive the production costs down so that consumers, be it the healthcare system or patients, can afford those medical goods. And how could this be mitigated? I believe that as long as the European Union and particularly the companies have a clear idea of what alternatives there are in case there is some breakdown of the supply chain, it should be possible to react promptly. I do hope that that is the case.
Right. Are there efforts already being made?
Yes. So taking also a little bit one step back, it is mostly in the area of generics where the EU is highly dependent on imports from other countries, especially China. And zooming in, for example, on antibiotics, here we have around like 80% of the active pharmaceutical ingredients are imported from China. And this is, of course, a great like supply chain bottleneck that can lead to serious shortages. And the reasons for the breakdown of these supply chains are various, right? It like starts with ships blocking canals, factories shutting down, but also, and like most worryingly, of course, geoeconomic coercion, right? And to overcome these shortages, it will not be enough to just stockpile medicines or to bring back production to Europe, which is currently the most favored option by policymakers, because like Pedro already said, these medicines have to be cheap because about 90% of medicines consumed by people in the EU are generics, which would probably overburden healthcare systems if they were all be produced inside the EU. So the key here, in my opinion, is diversification, production outside of the EU, but not in single countries. And this will cost money, of course, but there are some great cooperations already on the way, for example, with Western African countries, which also leads to kind of a win-win situation because these countries are also in dire need of these medicines, and strengthening local productions in these areas through the EU's economic power would not only provide these regions with medicines, but also create new trading partners for the EU.
Well, that actually leads me to my next question about coordinating efforts and perhaps staying within the EU for a second in order to improve health security and rights across the bloc, but even beyond, as you've just mentioned. What can EU members learn from one another? Perhaps we could hear of some specific examples of coordinated efforts like the one you've just given, Michiel.
Yeah. So the EU really has to show member states what the added value of EU action is and what the added value of not going on it by themselves, but joining forces is, which Pedro already also mentioned. And one example of this during the pandemic was the joint procurement of vaccines, where member states, let's take the debates on like what went also wrong with this procurement aside and just talk about the mechanism in itself, which was quite good in avoiding a bidding war between member states and having them rather join forces to procure vaccines. And the EU can, with these efforts, really show what its added value is. And it has now, as Pedro already mentioned, published a global health strategy. But now, almost two years down the line, there's still like the need to really show what it can actually do with this strategy. How is this an added benefit to the member states? And I would argue that the EU could provide indeed a platform for member states to develop their strategies and to take the lead on issues that are important to them. Let's say, for example, by facilitating working groups by member states on specific issues. For example, sexual and reproductive health and rights is high on the agenda of Germany and the German government, and other countries in the EU, for example, the Netherlands, also put in great effort on this issue in their respective global health strategies. So the EU could facilitate an exchange between these countries and, like I said, define working groups spearheaded by the countries, depending on who the country is that is most interested, let's say, in the issue. So be a facilitator and a coordinator, and the EU could do much more in that regard.
Well, and talking about Germany, of course, since the last pandemic, the political situation globally, but certainly within Europe, has changed somewhat. Perhaps we can talk about Germany's role in global health. We've seen the WHO hub for pandemic and epidemic intelligence open up here in Berlin since COVID. How significant is Germany's contribution to global health and to global health security, Pedro?
I believe Germany's contribution to global health security is quite substantive. It's one of the global leaders currently in the field, and it has been for a while. It actually began, this trend began since Chancellor Merkel back then during the West African Ebola crisis decided to step in and say we need to do more in terms of collaborating among other areas in the preparation against epidemics and pandemics, and has continued ever since to become a more active and a bigger player in the field. And I think during the COVID-19 pandemic, Germany, as a result of this previous trend, stepped up when the United States withdrew temporarily from the World Health Organization, and Germany even became the main contributor, financial contributor to the World Health Organization in terms of volume. It couldn't I believe it could not so far fully replace the United States in terms of the volume of financial contributions it can make on the longer term. That is, hopefully I could be wrong, but I don't see it happening so easily. And nevertheless, with the inauguration of the WHO Hub for Pandemic and Epidemic Intelligence, and this somehow guarantees that there will be a decades-long commitment to this particular project, this particular institution that will indeed contribute to analyzing data more more promptly whenever a future pandemic emerges. And more recently, I can mention that the World Health Summit took place in Berlin, the latest World Health Summit took place in Berlin in October of 2024. And this was also part of a so-called investment round where the WHO's finances would be replenished. And Germany led the way in ensuring that the European region as a whole would contribute to WHO. And they did so with up to $1 billion US dollars, which is not a minimal amount. But there are still big question marks with regards to what follows from that.
Well, of course, and the support is there, but this is not just about Europe, and we're talking about global health security. I mean, what impact will the re-election of Donald Trump to the White House have on global health, and how should Germany perhaps respond, particularly considering Trump's nomination of, for instance, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as U.S. Health Secretary?
I think Germany is in a privileged position, being the largest economy in the European Union on the one hand, and on the other hand, having a strong public health tradition more generally, to step up and try to offer a viable alternative to what seems to be a rising tide of either misinformation or, let's say, a reinterpretation of public health tenets, public health premises that were taken for granted, including with regards to vaccination, including with regards to the safety of certain health products. And I do believe that with this tradition, Germany, alongside other European Union partners that also have such a tradition, could stand their ground and offer the world an alternative to institutions, for instance, in the United States, which are very influential globally, But of course, when the tide shifts and the different views are espoused, this might have an impact beyond the United States. And here Europe can, the European Union and Germany in particular, can offer a counterweight to that impact.
Michael.
Yeah, exactly. I would totally second that. Like Peter already said, many countries, especially countries with less resources, look towards the United States, look towards the CDC and the FDA for regulatory reliance in order to assess the efficacy of vaccines, countries like El Salvador or Mexico. And the European Medicines Agency is also an important actor in that regard. And like Pedro also said, these agencies should and could step up their game and kind of fill the void that might be created through Secretary of Health like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who might change the CDC and the FDA in a very impactful way.
So I suppose it's about communication, but Pedro.
I also wonder the extent to which someone like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., if he were to be appointed to a position of Secretary of Health and Human Services, I'm not sure to what extent his decisions could really upend and revolutionize the way in which, for instance, the Food and Drug Administration and the CDC do their work. He would for sure have an impact, but it remains to be seen whether it's so easy, right, to change everything overnight. It might be, but then again, these are long-standing institutions. I don't mean to downplay, right, the risks, but of course, we can only hope that this there are strong institutional framework can somehow counter the more whimsical perspectives that one single person may have in the field of public health.
And I suppose that's communications and tackling misinformation. But what about, you've talked a little about financial support, but how can Germany hold up its commitment and contributions to the WHO and global health initiatives in an era of budget cuts? What should Berlin do, especially if it ends up filling a gap left by the US or a larger gap than expected?
It's first important to recognize that, as in every budget debate, everyone thinks their area is the most important one, right? And everyone thinks that cuts in their area would have the most devastating impact on whatever that area is. But I really want to stress that when it comes to health, it is important to underscore that health is an investment. And we have like pretty strong economic analysis on this investment. For example, between 2011 and 2020, the returns on investment from immunization programs was estimated at about $16 per dollar spent. And this is only to cost of illness savings, so just people not getting sick. If we add on top of that the impact on productivity and longer lifespans, we end up with, in this estimation, about $44 for every dollar spent. So it is a mid and long game, of course, and the effect is not that clear for policymakers, but it is not money ill spent in that sense. It will come back eventually through economic prosperity. So one would argue that this should not be the main driver for health spending, right? To say, oh, we get something in return for that, which benefits us economically. But the baseline is that also this is the case. So this should be an added motivator to say budget cuts here are not really something that will benefit us in any way.
And remaining with the global view of health challenges, this is not just about Trump. The world has become more fragmented since the pandemic, split by Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine and the escalating situation in the Middle East, just to name a couple of issues. What impact do geopolitical frictions have when it comes to international cooperation? Is multilateralism dead or seriously sick, Pedro?
I think it's for sure seriously sick, and but has been for a while. Even before COVID-19, multilateralism had reached an impasse on many fronts and on many topics. And the COVID-19 pandemic was sort of a catalyst. We were hoping that it would be a uniting event, and it wasn't. to the extent that we saw that either countries or regions responded with a me-first perspective, under a me-first perspective, and this, of course, only exposed the limits of multilateralism, which were further eroded when Russia invaded Ukraine, and of course the tragic situation in Gaza and in Israel. And I believe these events have been so traumatic and catastrophic that they risk undermining longer term projects that do depend on that collaboration, including for sure in the health sector. Because, for example, there will need to be some sort of international cooperation to rebuild the healthcare systems in Ukraine and in Gaza. And I really do not know whether the international community would have the resources and the political will to unite in reconstructing those healthcare systems, which I think should be a community interest for all states.
Michel.
Yeah, so maybe a little silver lining, while I totally agree with what you said, I would argue that the talks about the pandemic agreement or pandemic accord, the reform of the international health regulations show that there's still something going on here. There's still multilateralism ongoing and not dead, and countries trying to work together to overcome global health issues. However, there is geopolitical tension on the rise and countries also using health policy in order to foster their geopolitical interests, right? China used the so-called masks and vaccine diplomacy during the COVID pandemic in order to strengthen its foothold in certain regions with the prospect of later economic cooperation through this so-called Health Silk Road. And I would argue that two things are important to consider here for countries that, like Germany, are witnessing these developments. They should stay, of course, committed to multilateralism, which Germany is, and avoid at all costs to viewing their own global health efforts through this lens of geopolitical interests, but keep the geopolitics as far out as possible. But on the other hand, also, and this is the second part, countries must set up themselves and also multilateral institutions like the WHO in a way that makes them independent of individual actors. It's the same story in health matters as in any other issue area like security policy. If everything is built on, for example, the US or any other single entity playing ball in this system, the system will always be fragile.
Well, finally, and I have to ask, are we better prepared for the next pandemic, Michel?
I would say yes, at least in some respect. Developed countries have always viewed major outbreaks as an issue happening to low and middle income countries and not to them. And this has fundamentally changed and created a global momentum, especially also within the public and the civil society, that is unlikely to die down. And we've developed new tools or are currently in development of new tools to better respond to these outbreaks or even prevent them from happening. It will now all boil down to whether governments are willing to use these tools when the next big thing happens.
Well, I would say no, we're not better prepared, and I'm rather on the fence concerning some issues. So while I do agree that there's more awareness now of what might happen in future pandemics after what we lived through COVID-19, I still do not see a united political will to do things differently than what we saw during the COVID-19 pandemic. I don't see the necessary commitments, for instance, in terms of sharing medical goods during a pandemic, that would be needed for a really solidarity-based pandemic response. And on the one hand, and on the other hand, with regards to the rules you mentioned, the pandemic agreement and the international health regulations, we should be wary that some states might, on the one hand, not accept the international health regulations, the amendments that were recently approved, or might not be so willing to see the negotiations on a new pandemic agreement to the end, particularly now with the new U.S. administration, which could contribute to sabotage the entire process, though there are alternatives to deal with that. So I'm a bit less optimistic, sadly.
So some of that sounds reassuring, but it sounds as if there's quite a lot to do. And for today, we're nearly out of time, so I'd like to thank our guests, Pedro Villarreal and Michael Bayerlein. You'll find links to their latest work and projects in the podcast show notes. And if you like what you hear, you can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also keep up to date with the latest analyses from SWP on X, formerly Twitter, and on LinkedIn. So until next time, it's goodbye from our guests.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Goodbye.
And also from me, Esme Nicholson. Thank you for tuning in.